Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Staver, a show where we bring you different stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Today, we're starting off with a story about Ohio State sports, but not the sports you're probably thinking of. Esports, otherwise known as competitive video game playing, is growing in popularity. Ohio State even has a team, and this weekend, it's hosting the Big Ten Conference Championship. Joining me now is John Price, General Manager for Ohio State's eSport program. Welcome to All Sides.
Hi, Anne. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Alicia Leong, the eSports team student manager for Ohio State.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here.
So, John, for those who are scratching their heads right now, what are eSports and how did they become a thing?
Yeah, esports, best way to think of it, or at least in my mind, is kind of imagine it like a track meet, and there's all these different activities. There's the Valorant team that's playing. There's a Super Smash Brothers, kind of like your shot put, what have you. And it really what it is a collection of different video games that usually online, but in what's happening this weekend in person, you're playing against other individuals in a competition like you would for a 3-on-3 basketball tournament.
Alika, I think I said your name wrong at the beginning.
Yes, it is Alika.
Alika, I apologize.
No worries.
So, Alika, how did you get into this, and what game do you play?
I think with a lot of gamers that I know personally, we kind of started playing video games from when we were very young. For me, my dad was a gamer. He played video games, and that's how I got into gaming, you know. I currently play a lot of Rainbow Six Siege, Overwatch, but I do manage the Valorant team here at OSU, yes. Mm-hmm.
So what kind of games are those?
Those are actually all first-person shooters. Some are more tactical than others. I would say Rainbow Six Siege and Counter-Strike, the two of the games I play, they're more on like the tactical side, whereas Valorant's still tactical, but you do have a little bit of fantasy element. And then you have Overwatch, where half of the players are flying. So,
so it really runs the gambit in terms of what people can play competitively.
Exactly. I'll give you a great example of this. My first year here in 2022, a student walked into my office asking, hey, I just qualified for the national Microsoft Excel competition at Arizona State. And it's an example of you might be, if you're pretty good at Microsoft Office Suite, you might be able to compete in an esport someplace in the country.
I'm going to have to tell my husband that. That is wild. So if you're really good at pivot tables, you can go ahead and like compete.
Oh, yes.
So how did Ohio State come to realize like, hey, we should formalize this, we should have a team?
Well, it really goes back, if anything, decades, because gaming here on campus, and particularly in Ohio and Columbus in general, has just been a huge thing. And what happened was is a movement on campus to really kind of become a part of that larger collegiate scene started, and it culminated in 2019 when they built the esports arena over in Lincoln Tower on campus and then started the official premier teams. And so we now have four official teams that have jerseys, they have coaches, team managers, of course, and travel across the country for competitions now.
So this all happened right before COVID.
It did. The arena actually opened up 5 months before COVID. And so it was, if anything, though, funny enough, it helped us in a lot of ways because a lot more people kind of became aware of esports and gaming from being at home during the pandemic and the like. And there's kind of been a resurgence that's come from it.
Alika, you know, when we think of sports, we traditionally think of the physical kind of sports.
Right.
Do you think sometimes people don't take the difficulty of what you do seriously, if that makes sense? Like you're just playing video games?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Because it's kind of interesting because you can think of sports as a hobby, right? And then you can think of it as competitive. And when it comes to like video games, people just focus so much on the fact that, oh, it's a hobby, you're having fun, like because you're having fun it's not that serious, I guess. But yeah, I definitely think people don't take esports seriously because it's not physical, maybe. I'm not exactly sure why, but yeah.
John, Michigan State University became the first Big Ten school to actually offer a scholarship for esports. Akron now offers up to $2,500. Do you see Ohio State ever doing something similar?
I think anything's possible, and it definitely could at some point happen in the future. A lot depends on what a school is looking to do. And Akron is looking for esports oftentimes more for recruitment than what it is. Where here at Ohio State, we're focused a lot more on student engagement, professional opportunities through broadcasting, as well as providing a community space for it. And so I think it's definitely possible. And I'm very envious of Chris Bilski and what he's doing up at Michigan State. And they will be here actually this weekend as well competing. But it's one of those things of where it depends very much on the different schools and their priorities.
So tell me a little bit about this weekend. What is happening? Who all's coming? Can we go watch in person?
Great question. So what's happening this weekend is officially it's called the Big Esports Conference, and it's formed of all the schools that are also part of the Big Ten Conference, of course. And so we have all schools were invited. 13 of them in total are going to be coming, and we're going to be competing in four different titles: Valorant, Overwatch 2, Rocket League, and Super Smash Brothers. And so much like kind of we just wrapped up, of course, the March Madness and everything else and crowned the national champion last night, we'll be doing this similar to almost like the run-up of the Big Ten tournament that happens to get a seed into nationals in a similar way. So unfortunately, we don't have enough room because we're going to have about 200 plus or so participants across campus for this event. But you will be able to tune in online via twitch.tv and see a stream of the event and watch it live.
Elika, are you competing?
I will not be competing. I will be over there overseeing both the Valorant team and the Super Smash Brothers Ultimate team.
I will say Elika's underselling what she does, because what she does is a team manager, but also broadcasting. So she will get in front of a mic and shoutcast some of the matches as well as help behind the scenes. But Elika's a key organizer for both their Super Smash Brothers team that we got organized for this event, as well as for our Valorant team throughout the semester.
So there are 40 higher education institutions in Ohio with esports programs. And I got to admit, that kind of surprised me. And when you look at total number nationwide, I mean, we're in the tens of thousands.
Exactly. And when you look at high school and middle schools, that number just grows astronomically. It's crazy to think we're coming up on the 10-year anniversary of the first college that announced an official esports program. And from where that was back in 2014 to now, it has really grown almost exponentially. And it shows no sign of stopping. It's just growing larger and larger. And in fact, there's only two schools I know of in the Big Ten that don't have a facility dedicated to esports some way: Indiana and that university up north.
Elika, there's no overarching governing body like the NCAA. Do you think that's a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, with anything really, the not having one overarching thing is a good thing, because it creates competition and it creates the drive for any. It's not esports specifically, right? I'm studying health and rehabilitation sciences at OSU, so we know that when there isn't just one organizer, you know, it creates competition, it creates drive for organizations to do better. So in that sense, it is nice. But also you have that lack of cohesiveness within the organization, you know. It would be nice for us to really have a good way to compare our teams across all the different games if we had one organization to do that.
I assume you guys have some sort of formalized agreement for these tournaments, though, like a set of rules and standards.
Yeah, there are sets of rules and standards, and a lot of different conferences will copy homework from one another, so to speak. But just kind of like as Elika says, is that there is enough kind of variety of where you get a little bit different, almost kind of like your different American versus... Well, now I'm showing my lack of knowledge of traditional athletics in any way, shape, or form. But you might have, a designated hitter in one league, but no designated hitters in another. It's very similar to that in esports as well.
So some teams travel to compete. Obviously, there are teams coming in from across the Big Ten, which is a really, it's increasingly a misnomer. given that there are so many more teams. What kind of budget does Ohio State have to travel?
So we usually try to have enough of a budget to send our teams between 4 to 6 different LAN events a year and such. And so, and travel might be actually our Overwatch 2 team went to the University of Kentucky just the other week. Our Rocket League team went to Penn State to compete in the $10,000 Collegiate Cup that was being hosted there. And so we have a it's definitely been growing rapidly, and some schools have actually added multiple different full-time staff in addition to now support their programs. Using Michigan State as an example, I think they just brought on their third full-time person just in the last couple of months.
Elika, you know, one of the things we talk about with college athletics in the last couple of years is NIL, or the ability to make money off your name, your image, your likeness, basically to enter into brand contracts through your social media primarily. Is that something that esports teams get? Like, are there brands looking to sponsor you guys or work with you guys?
I cannot emphasize enough how important branding is to the esports scene. Yeah, we rely a lot on that content, that branding, that name to for a lot of our funding and budgets. That's kind of like the more business side of things, you know. Esports organizations, we don't rely on the teams to make the money for us. We do rely on like that content side of things. You know, we're not using merch or having players win prize money for that. So if we want esports to be like esports organization to be a long-term sustainable organization, we do rely very much so on NIL, you said?
Yeah, it's yes. The ability to sell your name, your image, or your likeness.
Right. Yes.
Basically, to get sponsored.
Yes.
So it sounds like, it doesn't surprise me. I think probably there's lots of like game manufacturers that would want to get a new game in your hands and have you play it.
Right. Yeah. We actually did recently have a Lenovo sponsored event. So it does go to show that we do rely on other brands to, you know, support us.
So if somebody out there listening has a kid who's really into video games, like, what should they be doing to help them along?
Well, one that's a great idea is actually summer camps. So there are esports summer camps out there. So we're actually offering a camp this summer in July, 2 different weeks, for 10 to 13-year-olds who can come to the Ohio State Esports Arena, spend a week learning everything from broadcast, from tactics for the various games that we're going to be working on or what have you. And so that's a great way of doing it. But besides that, it's getting to know it, much like you would for any hobby one of your kids was in, whether it was cheerleading, wrestling, rocketry, or what have you, just spending that time to learn a bit about it is makes a huge difference. I've met a lot of parents of who, even though they know that this isn't their favorite thing in the world, they see just how much it means to their kid. And just that little bit of effort is goes a long way and provides a lot of support for them.
And getting comfortable with the controllers, like for like those of us that grew up with the original Nintendo, it can be a little intimidating.
Oh, yes, very much so. But it doesn't take too long to get used to it, that's for sure.
So, Elika, what do you, is this, I don't want to call it a hobby since, you know, you're calling it a sport. What do you plan to do with it going forward? I know you said that you've got a different major.
I know you said you don't want to call it a hobby. And, you know, it's okay to recognize that it is a hobby for some people. And I am definitely one of those person in which it is a hobby for. You know, I love video games. I talk to my friends a lot through video games. I meet a lot of people through video games and such. But honestly, after college, it's just going to be a hobby for me, you know? I really enjoyed being part of, like, the esports department, organizing, seeing what that's like. And, you know, it helps me see the professional esports in a different light. And it's okay that it's just a hobby for me, yeah.
And one thing I'll add to that is what Elika described is what the vast majority of people that are part of the program are. Is this is much a small portion of their lives, and this is where they meet friends. I know I've had friends that I've known for 20 years meeting through gaming, and gaming is I never intended it to turn into what it is now. I was a professor before this, but for most of it, it is one of those comfortable things that they'd go home and do. They jump on Discord, which is kind of their way to
chat room for gamers.
Yeah, chat for gamers. Yeah, exactly. And they get to meet their friends who might be living across the country. I mean, there aren't a lot of activities where you can do that and just hop on and be talking to a college roommate from 5, 10, 20 years ago and play a video game after a long day of work.
But for some, it does actually lead to money and almost a professional gig. Mm-hmm. Like, I was really surprised. I kind of thought of it a little bit like poker tournament champions. Like, the big international competitions, like, end with big payouts.
Massive. I think one of the largest is the international, which is for a game called Dota 2, of where on average some of their prize pools have gotten up to $25 million in the past. There definitely is an industry, and it's continuing to grow and thrive in the modern world, and I just expect that to continue into the future.
Final question, Elika. What is the best video game out there?
Oh my goodness. What a very difficult question to answer.
Or what's your favorite of the moment?
Okay, well, I think that's slightly easier to answer. I mean, like, you know, I'm just going to say my favorite for a while actually has been The Last of Us. It's a single-player game. It's not esports. I'm sure there are ways you can play the game competitively, but it's more known as a single-player game with a great story. And honestly, I grew up on zombie games, and it is a zombie game. I watched my dad play zombie games, Resident Evil, stuff like that. So it has a special place in my heart. Yeah.
And they turned it into a really good show, too. It was a great television show.
Yeah, still have not yet to see that, but I'm sure it is.
Do you have a favorite game at the moment?
Oh, let's see. Right now, I'm playing their genre is roguelike called Bellatico. It's a poker game, or it uses kind of the rules of poker to play this really interesting card game. And so I've been playing way, way too much of it. So it's very popular right now.
That was John Price, the general manager of Ohio State's eSport program. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And thank you to Elika Leong, the eSport team manager for Ohio State.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, the controversy over solar farms. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides, a show where we bring you different stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Our second topic is also located here in Ohio, in Knox County to be specific, where a proposed solar energy project is dividing the community. Joining us to talk about it is Cleveland-based reporter Kathy Ann Kowalski of the Energy News Network. Welcome to All Sides.
Hello, glad to be here.
And WOSU's own reporter, Ali Vugrinsik, who's been covering the controversy over the Fraser Solar Project. Welcome.
Hi, Anna.
It's good to see you. Ali, can you set the scene for us? So what is being proposed and why are people so up in arms about this?
Yeah, so the Fraser Solar Project would be about 120 megawatts and nearly a little over 800 acres. But they want to build it on about 40 like separate disconnected farm fields in Miller and Clinton Townships, a little bit in Mount Vernon. Miller and Clinton Townships are right south of Mount Vernon. And people are up in arms about it for like a number of reasons, or so they claim. Critics of the projects have thrown out things like, what if it's damaged by hailstorms, or what if it leaks toxic stuff into the soil? really, the big debate, though, ends up being about land use in this case, where folks are worried that with the housing crisis in this area, this farmland could potentially turn into housing developments. And you have people who are saying, I'd rather have solar panels on this farmland, and then it can go back to being farmland after the solar panels go away. And you have folks saying, well, shouldn't we be using this space for housing if we're going to use it for something? And it also has a big, land right question, where people are asking, shouldn't the farmers get to decide how they want to use their land?
Kathy Ann, you actually wrote about two cousins in Knox County who are in favor of the project. Can you tell us what they told you about property rights?
Sure. Basically, their feeling is that this is a way for them to keep the land in their family. It's a way for them to continue to earn income from the land. And they also talked with the developer at length about conditions. And as they see it, this is a way, if their kids choose in 40 years that they want to go back to farming, they have the chance of restoring it. And I was told that really no other use can be so easily reversed. So that they just feel that it preserves all sorts of options. And also, there's another farmer who raises sheep who wants to graze his herd there. And he said, as a first-generation farmer, that's really the only way he can get access to more land at this point.
So, Allie, there is a well-funded opposition group to these farmers leasing parts of their land to be solar farms. But we don't know a lot about who's funding that opposition group. What's going on there?
Yeah, so there actually are two opposition groups. There's Preserve Knox County, which has been described to me by residents as a grassroots group of, Miller Township people who got together and made signs and they're going to the meetings, yada, yada. There's this second group that kind of cropped up a little later called Knox Smart Development. And they have these really big events. Kathy Ann actually attended one of their big events. They've got refreshments, they've got national speakers, they pull out advertisements online and in newspapers. But the guy who incorporated Knox Smart Development, Jared Yost, won't answer questions about where the money's coming from. He just says, it's these folks want to remain anonymous, but they're interested in backing our cause. This might be a better question for Kathy Ann, because she's the one who was my source in telling me about the Empowerment Alliance, which is something you could call like a dark money group.
So where are they getting the money for these national speakers and big fancy events?
Well, they're not telling us where they're getting the money for it, but the MC at their November meeting worked with one of the biggest contractors for the Empowerment Alliance. And that group has been connected by the Energy and Policy Institute to the Aerial Corporation, which happens to be also headquartered in Knox County. And they make equipment for oil and gas development. They also had a speaker who is listed as an expert for the Heartland Institute, which opposes clean energy and has links to fossil fuel interests. A speaker at their February meeting was formerly with the Manhattan Institute, which other groups have also connected with fossil fuel interests. Somebody was with a group up in Michigan, and they've likewise been connected. So even though the organization, Knox Smart Development, is not saying where the money is coming from, the people that are coming in have these links. And in one case, one of the speakers apparently usually charges $10,000 per appearance. So these are not minor expenses.
So it sounds like there's some hints or clues that oil and gas money might be tied to some of these anti-solar groups.
At least some concomitant interests.
So, Allie, Ohio's kind of in the middle of the pack when it comes to solar power. Just 1% of our state's electricity comes from solar energy, so it's not a ton, but it is a growing market, which maybe isn't something we would think of when we think of the Midwest.
No, it's certainly not your first thought. You think of clouds here. Last October, I actually got to tour another solar project called Yellowbud Solar Farm, and that's about 45 minutes south of Columbus. And while I was there, we're out walking around with all these, you know, people who put the project together and the funders and yada yada, and it started to rain. And I got a lot of very funny pictures of people with umbrellas on a solar farm. But what they told me was that it didn't matter. The panels still produce energy even when it's raining. As long as the sun is up, they're producing energy. And most of today's solar panels are also designed to tilt with the sun. So as the sun moves from east to west, the panels follow it. I suppose yesterday would have been an exception because the sun went away for a few minutes. But as a rule, they work pretty well here in Ohio. Let me look at my cheat sheet here. The Solar Energy Industry Association actually, in their most recent ranking, says Ohio is like around 17th. So we're creeping up. We're still in the middle, but we were lower in the 20s last year. So we're getting good with solar.
Kathy Ann, some big tech companies seem to be behind some of these newer projects. So Bill Gates is actually a partial owner of a solar farm in Madison County. That's wild.
Well, one of the things that you see is a lot of large companies want to move to all clean energy by mid-century, and they're concerned about climate change, not just in terms of being tree huggers, but also in terms of business risk that it presents. And so they have these commitments that they want to make. And if you are building a large data center or, as we see growth of artificial intelligence, other projects, there is an expected need for more energy. And solar is a way to get that additional energy without adding more pollution.
Yeah, that's one of the things we've talked about during this hour before, is just the massive amount of computing power and energy that goes into AI. And especially as it expands, we have to have the energy to meet that ever-increasing demand for it. I want to talk a little bit about Senate Bill 52. This was passed back in 2021, and it allows communities here in Ohio to keep solar and wind farms from all or part of their territories. So I guess this is a question for either of you. What effect has that had in determining where these solar farms are going?
It's had a substantial effect. I looked up some data this morning. In 2021, there were almost 25 applications filed with the Ohio Power Siting Board. That dropped to maybe 5 in 2022, about the same number, 4 or 5 in 2023. The number approved also has gone down. And that's a concern for developers, both in terms of can they site things here, and also just what are the standards. The Knox project that we talked about for Fraser Solar is considered grandfathered, meaning that it began the licensing project before Senate Bill 52 came into effect. So while there are going to be local representatives as ad hoc decision makers, it still has some effect. But the law is having an effect, and we do not see that same kind of veto power or if somebody wants to site a natural gas power plant or even oil and gas drilling or any other kind of facility other than wind.
Yeah, and Kathy had mentioned the Fraser project being grandfathered in. So it's not directly affected by this, but the recent primary election in Knox County, the county commissioners, a lot of them ran their campaigns as being strongly anti-solar. These were Republicans in primaries for 2 seats. And the incumbent, Tom Collier, lost. And one of the things that people kept throwing back at him was that the board that he was on had used that law and they had prohibited wind power, but they left the door open for solar on a case-by-case basis, and some people really didn't like that. So it's not going to affect the Fraser project, but it might affect future projects in that the board has changed in part because of that.
Oh, that's really interesting. I actually want to talk a little bit about the Ohio Power Siting Board. I know it sounds wonky, but they're pretty important in getting these solar farms approved, right, Allie?
Oh, yes.
So what do they do? Who sits on the board? Like,
oh, God.
You don't have to have names, but just like, is it they, energy executives? Like, who gets to be on the board?
They have heads of several agencies that sit on the board. The chair of it is Jennifer French. Who is also the head of the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio. But then there are also seats for Director of Development, the Ohio Department of Natural Resources. There is a public member. I'm trying to get the list of board members.
So it's some pretty important people here in Ohio.
Right. You've got, I've got the list. You've got Jennifer French, Ann Vogel from the Ohio EPA, Gregory Stone, who's an engineer, the public member, Bruce Vanderhoff, the director of the Department of Health.
Oh, okay.
And Lydia Mihalik, the director of the Department of Development, Brian Baldridge, who is
former state rep.
Right. And he's now the head of the Department of Agriculture. So you have these representatives from different agencies who sit on that board.
And they regulate the installation of these projects, correct?
Yes. You need their go-ahead in order to build any of these projects.
Do they ever reject projects?
Oh, yes. Yes, they do. And there are a couple of rather important solar cases pending before the Ohio Supreme Court right now, where everything was fine under the statutory criteria for each of two solar projects, but the board rejected them based on a public interest standard that is not very well defined. And the board didn't articulate that very clearly, other than perhaps acting like it was counting up people on one side versus another, which is not the way the statute says it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be a decision of really what is in the public interest.
So, Allie, what's next for Knox County?
Well, Knox County just had their public hearing with the Ohio Power Siting Board, and that was a formal hearing where the residents gave formal testimony for or against it in front of a legal judge from the Ohio Power Siting Board. And I believe the next thing on the list is an evidentiary hearing, which is going to be similar but less testimony-based. And then I think it goes to approval. Does that sound right to you, Kathy Ann?
That's generally right, except that they need to add another local public hearing because they didn't get through everybody last Thursday night. They got through maybe half of 140 people who signed up to talk. And I checked with the Ohio Power Siting Board this morning, and they said they have not set that follow-up hearing. They still have the big evidentiary hearing set for April 29, but if I had to place a bet, I would bet that would move.
So why do you think these solar projects get so contentious?
You know, looking specifically at Fraser in Knox County, what's really struck me is that so many of the arguments for or against it have nothing to do with energy. There are some things that talk about, you know, oh, does the energy generated even stay here, or where does it go, and where does Ohio get its energy? But most of these people aren't worried about clean energy versus fossil fuels, at least not the local residents. I don't know if it's a NIMBY thing or what it is, but people just don't seem to like the change is what I've seen from hanging out down there. If you drive these rural roads, you'll see these yellow signs that say no industrial solar. But it's not everybody because, you know, right next door, you've got somebody with a green yard sign that says, yes, solar. It's just, it's interesting and it is insanely divisive.
Kathy Ann, I have to feel like if you live there in that community, it's got to be so difficult to drive down that road and see all those different colored signs and know that your neighbors are fighting with each other, essentially.
I mean, I don't live in Knox County, but it is a contentious issue. Part of it is that I think there's a lot of misinformation floating around, though, and I think that stokes a lot of opposition and stokes a lot of the controversy. So, for example, within the last couple of weeks, there was this, you know, anonymous Ohio Energy reporter mailed to people. And when I tried to contact, you know, I reached out to the email address they gave and it bounced back as undeliverable. And nothing had a byline. And there were some things in it that just were not scientifically true. So I think some of those interests stoke the opposition and call me a cynic, but I think often people are afraid of competition as well as being afraid of change.
That was Kathy Ann Kowalski, a journalist for Energy News Network. Thank you for your time today.
Sure, glad being here.
And thanks to WOSU's own Ali Vugrinsik. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, Disney has entered the virtual reality market with what's being called a magic floor. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Staver. Our final segment today starts with a magic floor. A Disney magic floor, to be specific. These tilting floor tile discs are called hollow tiles. And here to tell us about them is Russell Holly, managing editor for commerce at CNET. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So, what is a hollow tile and how does it work?
Yeah, so Disney announced this thing that they were working on in their Imagineering facility a while back called Hollow Tiles, and the goal was to create flooring that made it so in immersive experiences, potentially with use cases like VR, or really just, you know, environments where you had kind of a limited amount of space, but you wanted to create the perception of movement, that you had these special floor panels that would move things either further away from you or closer to you and make it so that you could essentially walk in place without, you know, feeling like you were walking in place, so that you could be in a hallway and the hallway may be perceived to be longer because you were moving down this hallway, but the hallway wasn't actually moving. That was kind of Disney's goal. But what they've managed to create is a set of tiles that can be applied in just about any kind of, you know, kind of perspective enhanced experience, like if you're wearing a VR headset for training, or if you just want to create, you know, kind of the funhouse experience of, you know, not really running down a hallway.
So the tiles themselves, do they move?
Sort of. So each tile is a whole bunch of little circles, and the little circles rotate to the left and to the right, and they can also tilt up and down and left and right. And they all work together as you take a step to make it so that you feel like you're taking a step, but the tiles themselves are the things that are moving. All of those little circles move in conjunction so that you don't actually take that step forward, even though your body acknowledges that it has done so.
That's kind of trippy.
It's a little on the weird side. And that was kind of the interesting thing in the demonstration that we were given. It wasn't just that you could take a step and not really take a step, but that you could create, you know, this being Disney, obviously you could create a sort of artificial, like use the force effect where you could reach your hand out and something from across the room moves closer to you or moves farther away. It's not just You know, anything that is applying pressure to one of these tiles can be manipulated in this way.
So Bridget Carey reviewed The Magic Floor for CNET, and she asked this great question in her review, and I want to get your take on it, which is this how the Star Trek holodeck is born?
And in many ways, the answer is yes. You know, not to get too particularly nerdy here, but the whole concept of the holodeck is to keep you kind of centered in a room while a whole bunch of things are happening around you. You don't really know that you're walking, you know, in a single space, that it feels like you're traveling in, you know, a better, you know, kind of more in-depth space than you actually are. This is kind of the basis for that, is moving without actually moving.
So where is Disney going to use these tiles? Is there going to be like immersive experiences at the Magic Kingdom?
Yeah, so they haven't said specifically that the tiles are going to be used in one particular application or another, but, you know, Disney builds these things initially for their parks experiences first. So it's likely we would see this in a new expansion to one of the parks that they have announced that is coming over the next couple of years. It could be that, you know, because the Imagineering department is more about creating technology that other teams get to, you know, kind of figure out where they get used later, that this doesn't actually have a target destination yet. But I think what Disney has seen is there's been an incredible amount of positive response for this, including engineers at NASA reaching out to Disney to try and see if this could be used for artificial environment training. There's a surprising number of people that I have seen kind of gather around this concept with a lot of interest, not just in an entertainment space.
So it'll be a while before you can buy them and build your own holodeck at home.
It's probably going to be a while, but if it's something that becomes available, I can see this being really interestingly applied to just a bunch of different places.
Let's move on to Rejoin. I hope I'm saying that correct. It's an app to help treat depression, but you need a prescription for it.
That's right. This is actually, Rejoin is a prescription app for treating major depressive disorders. And, you know, they're... It's not uncommon to see, you know, kind of apps or kind of wellness systems that get released on your phone that are often in the quality of like, you know, enhanced journaling or maybe like group therapy sessions. But this has actually been approved by the FDA as a treatment method for certain kinds of depression.
That is so fascinating. So it's meant to supplement care, like in conjunction with a clinician. How have the tests gone on this app?
So far, the tests have been really positive. The way that it gets described is it's not focusing on treating like neurochemical imbalances. So this doesn't replace a prescription medicine that would help with neurochemical imbalances, but instead it tackles something called neuroplasticity, which is there are a couple different apps that you can find now that do you know, just kind of consumer level you know, kind of mind games in order to make it so that you feel a little faster and you know, kind of your cognitive responses are kind of improved over time. This is more in kind of that lane where it's you know, the goal here is to impart what they call cognitive emotional training instead of treating this on a chemical level.
That's really interesting. I never thought we'd see the day where you needed a prescription for an app you download on your phone, but here we are.
Yeah, and the prescription is essentially set up so that it's done on kind of a weekly assignment basis, where each week you're given 6 tasks to complete within the app, and some of them can be, you know, kind of touching specific points on the screen within different times. You know, it's kind of measured as a 6-week treatment course, according to the folks at Rejoin.
So, for those who watched or read or, you know, had any participation in the eclipse yesterday, social media, I mean, I saw so many pictures of totality where I'm from, but searches for why do my eyes hurt went up dramatically after this event, right?
Dramatically is a fun way of putting it. It increased by more than 4,000%. Just after the eclipse reached totality. And it was actually a combination of my eyes hurt and why do my eyes hurt? The folks asking why, I really have other questions for. But yeah, this is something that, you know, a ton of scientists warned about in kind of the days ahead. Even just walking out in my neighborhood yesterday, I saw kids get off the bus and the very first thing they did was look straight up. So it's kind of a it's not super surprising, but it is a little alarming that so many people put themselves in that situation.
Yeah, actually, the morning of the event, so yesterday morning, there was a recall issued for one of the more popular eclipse glasses that were sold on Amazon, which is not a good moment to find out that your glasses aren't going to work.
Yeah, this is an ongoing problem where things get listed on Amazon and they have all of the markings on them of having been a certified product. And then later on, it turns out that that thing wasn't actually certified, that that company just artificially printed the registration number on this device in order to sell it. We have seen this with larger purchases like hoverboards. And now with these cardboard glasses, there have been a number of demonstrations where straight from Amazon, the packages that were ordered, one that was actually certified and one that was not, and the difference was kind of scary because the one that was not was really more like regular sunglasses, which would not protect you at all.
So maybe that's why some people's eyes hurt. They bought the glasses, but they didn't realize they bought fake glasses.
Right, and there's no really way of knowing, when you get a lot of the packages that show up, they're printed right on the paper glasses that they're, kind of certified and they've been tested, but that is very much not the case.
Speaking of the genuine article, Meta, the company that owns Facebook and Instagram, is expanding its efforts to label AI content.
Yes, one of the things that has, one of the easier things to predict. When all of the kind of AI silliness started over the last 2 years was how frequent it was going to be for things that were not really real to be shared across social media. And at least on my personal accounts, a lot of what you see right now is fairly harmless. But it's things like what would happen if this blender was made Star Wars style? And so there are people who are like, oh man, I'd really like to buy that. Where can I buy that? But you can't. It's not actually a thing that exists. Some of them range, we've had several conversations now about how that can become quite dangerous, especially in a fractured, kind of political space towards an election. But the goal here, from Meta's perspective, is to just generally speaking, do a better job of labeling these things that are very clearly AI generated as AI generated so that folks aren't so easily confused.
Yeah, actually, there were a number of pretty popular photos of the eclipse, particularly of one that was supposedly taken in outer space that turned out to be fake.
That's
So
right.
even with the eclipse photos, there are AI-generated ones floating around.
Yeah, it's everything. There is currently in my social circles a group of moms who are upset that Build-A-Bear started announcing a way to make your own Bahamut stuffed animal. Not even remotely real. Totally an AI generated thing to make people think that Build-A-Bear was engaging in satanic imagery, which is not the case.
Oh my goodness. So, what are other companies like TikTok and YouTube doing in this space?
They're not doing nearly as much. There's, Meta's big thing right now is to make it so that there is a clear made with AI label when its systems detect AI involvement for generating things like images and video. That's not going to completely cover things because a lot of that relies on kind of digital watermarking that can be removed before it is published on social media. So some, kind of other form of involvement is going there. But yeah, as far as TikTok and Twitter and Instagram, a lot of the focus has been on making sure that any obvious sources, so OpenAI's Sora platform, would be labeled. But that's only going to capture a small percentage of some of the stuff that's being generated right now.
So Meta has also made the point that they plan to enforce their rules. What does that look like? What's the penalty out there for trying to pass off AI images as the genuine article?
So almost all forms of social media right now have a version of like a strikes system. It's not necessarily three strikes and you're out, but it is, a certain number of warnings and you lose functionality. There are probably some folks listening to this who are familiar with accidentally saying something in the wrong order on Facebook when their systems are dialed up a little too high and you're not allowed to post for 24 hours because you use the wrong combination of words. Something to that effect is what would happen here with Meta's platforms. So if you were on Instagram and you used AI generated tools without properly labeling it, it caused some sort of controversy. There would be a strike placed against you for doing that, and that would limit your ability to post in groups and things like that. And if you were to bypass that and violate that rule a second time, then that period where you were unable to use your account would become longer until it was just completely turned off.
Here's hoping they don't get it wrong. I would hate to be trying to explain that it really was my own work.
That is an ongoing conversation is to exactly how correct these things are going to end up being and what the edge cases will look like when someone who was not using AI is blamed to do so.
Well, that was Russell Hawley, Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
And that'll do it for Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Staver. Thank you for listening to 89.7 NPR News.